The Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize was established by and made possible by my predecessor, Jim Steubendick. In 2005, he had a great idea. As you can see from the posters out in the lobby, when we pick winners, we pick winners. Today, as most of you know, our prize has been renamed the Steubendick Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize, and the cash award has been raised from $5,000 to $10,000. Jim and his wife, Cheryl, are with us today. Could you please stand and be recognized? Thank you very much. The winning book each year is selected by an eminent committee with assistance from many other readers. That process is described in more detail in a lovely little essay by Mila Saskova-Pierce that will appear in the fall issue of Great Plains Quarterly, which will be out in early November. Mila was the chair of our selection committee this year, and she and other members of the committee are, first of all, Mila, then David Wedeen, and Wendy Katz. This year we recognize as the winner of the first Steubendick Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize, Elizabeth Fenn, for her book, Encounters at the Heart of the World, A History of the Mandan People. Professor Fenn received her BA from Duke University and her PhD from Yale. She taught at George Washington University and Duke University before moving in 2012 to the University of Colorado at Boulder, where she is now the department chair. Her previous books include Natives and Newcomers, The Way We Lived in North Carolina Before 1770, written with Peter Wood and published in 1983, and Pox Americana, The Great Smallpox Epidemic of 1775 to 82, published in 2002. Now, the book we honor today is a wonderful exploration of the difficult and simultaneously inspiring history of the Mandan people. Fenn uses all forms of evidence and knowledge, from archaeological finds to oral traditions to intense documentary analysis, and she leavens her history with her own experiences exploring the region. It's really a bravura performance, fun to read and impressive in its scope. I want to share with you just one paragraph from Mila Saskova-Pierce's essay on the book. Quote, the author narrates the history of the Mandans from many perspectives, including the Mandans themselves. Though the reader knows about the devastating smallpox outbreak of 1837 from the outset, the book is a sort of mystery, pulling the reader into the plot of a reversed detective story. We know the outcome and are learning about the historical events that led to it. At many points, Fenn offers the possibility of a different path, such as available inoculations, that could have altered the tragedy that befell the Mandan civilization. The reader learns step by step how it happened that more than 12,000 Mandans before the encounter with Europeans were reduced to fewer than 300 by the middle of the 19th century. Today, the 21st century Mandans are a federally recognized tribe with several hundred members. Ultimately, the book demonstrates the fragility and vulnerability of any culture in the face of military conquest and social engineering, unquote. It's now my duty and pleasure to present the Steubendick Book Prize Medal. Lil, if you would come up. Here is the Steubendick Book Prize Medal. On one side it says, Center for Great Plains Studies, University of Nebraska. And on the other side it says, 2015, Steubendick Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize, Encounters at the Heart of the World, A History of the Mandan People by Elizabeth A. Fenn. Congratulations. There's also a small check that goes along with it. Now, many of you know that this book also won the Pulitzer Prize this year for history. And I just want to commend the Pulitzer Committee for following our lead in recognizing this book. A little research on the internet shows that the Pulitzer Prize cash award is $10,000. As you can see, I have pinned a dollar bill to our check. I'm certainly hoping and confident that I will be hearing in the halls of the Boulder History Department comments such as, "Sure, the Pulitzer is nice, but you make more money with the Stubendick." Again, congratulations. Thanks. Congratulations. Her talk today, Encounters at the Heart of the World. Now, our book prize winner, Elizabeth Fenn.
Okay, can everybody hear me? Excellent. First, thank you all for coming today. It is a real pleasure to be here and to be able to share this most American of stories with you. Before I plunge in, I want to thank Rick, Katie Nyland, Lisa Maupin, and of course, Jim and Cheryl Stubendick for funding this wonderful prize. I've never been to the Plains Center before, and it's really a treat to be at a place that celebrates the history of a region that I have really come to love. Now, many audiences that I talk to feel a bit flummoxed when they see the title of my lecture, because many people aren't quite sure who the Mandans are. And I suspect that's not the case for this audience. You know, but you know, for many Americans, Mandan or Nueta doesn't have the familiar ring of Cherokee or Narragansett, Comanche, or Seminole. But most people find that, like you, they do know about the Mandans. And they know about the Mandans because the explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark and their Corps of Discovery spent the winter of 1804 and 1805 among the Mandans on the outbound portion of their famous transcontinental journey. So the Mandans were Earth Lodge dwellers who live on the Missouri River to this day, in the middle of what is now known as North Dakota. What I am going to do today is, in sort of a horse race kind of fashion, I'm going to use the tools of environmental history to examine what happened on the Upper Missouri River between 1500 and 1837. In those years, the Mandans faced an unprecedented series of ecological challenges. Many, although not all of those challenges, related in some way to the arrival of new peoples, a new species on the North American continent. So the Mandans had made their homes at what they called the heart of the world, the confluence of the Heart River flowing in from the west and the Missouri. They'd made their homes at the heart of the world since around the year 1300. I should say the Mandans and their ancestors had made their homes at this place since around the year 1300. Many indigenous peoples, as I'm sure you're aware, use similar kinds of designations for their homelands. In the case of the Mandans, however, this is this designation, the heart of the world, is particularly appropriate. The heart of the world was, in fact, less than 100 miles from the geographic center of the North American continent. The Mandans also occupied a distinctive ecological niche. They were farmers. They grew corn in tremendous quantities despite living at the northern limit of maize cultivation and despite living beyond the 100th meridian, which was is the widely accepted western boundary of non-irrigated agriculture. Now, Mandans also harvested meat, especially bison, to complement the grain and vegetable yield of their gardens. In the summer, they killed the animals on the grasslands that extended in all directions around their towns. And in the winter, when weather often drove people and bison alike into the sheltered river bottoms, they hunted in the riparian forest, from which these animals barely budged before temperatures warmed. And then, in the spring, the Mandans harvested delectable float bison, seasoned drowned animals that drifted by their towns when the ice broke up. Now, I know we laugh at float bison, they don't seem delectable to us, but actually there are long-standing ancient traditions of eating fermented meat among cultures around the world. And in fact, if you have ever had a salami sandwich, you've done it too. The villagers also acquired bison products by trading with itinerant visitors, offering them handicrafts, farmstuffs, and other items in return. Now, bison aside, you might think that the Mandans' reliance on agriculture in a land of sparse rain, intense cold, short growing seasons, you might think this was a tenuous choice. But the villagers found security, or at least food security, through diversification. To accommodate a growing season, typically fewer than 130 days long, Mandan women cultivated at least 9, possibly as many as 14 different varieties of maize. And these varieties all serve different horticultural, culinary, nutritional, even ceremonial purposes. They also ripened in different conditions and at different speeds, typically taking 90 to 105 days. And so by making successive plantings to take advantage of varietal traits, Indian women ensured that a rogue frost didn't destroy the whole crop. Now, rainfall also posed a challenge. Average rainfall in this region today is only around 17 inches per year. One of the ways that Mandan women accommodated this was by planting in the river bottoms, where capillary action pulled moisture upward to thirsty roots in all but the driest of seasons. Now, of course, there were times when rains failed. There were times when ears of corn shriveled on the stalk. But when this happened, the villagers, or I should say more particularly, the village women, had a backup plan. They turned to vast stores of dried maize, beans, squash, and sunflower seeds that they kept on hand for trade, for winter consumption, and for emergencies. Archaeologists have tallied up almost 70,000 bushels of underground storage capacity in the cash pits at a single Mandan village. This is the early Mandan or pre-Mandan town of Huff. Now, I was talking with some folks about, you know, my background and all before we got started today. I grew up in New Jersey. So bushels were not really a part of my lexicon. I had to go look it up. And just to give you a benchmark, I mean, y'all probably know you're from Nebraska, right? But a bushel is 8 gallons of capacity. One bushel of dried shelled maize weighs 56 pounds. So think about 70,000 bushels. Now, the villagers may not have used all this capacity at once, but the Huff Village site was only occupied for about 20 years. So the extent of these food stores for consumption and trade alike was truly mind-boggling. Now, the Mandans did have times of hardship in which meat in particular was hard to come by. But full-fledged famine appears to have been rare. And in fact, it was so rare that a Mandan winter count keeper, y'all know what, have you heard of winter counts? Well, okay. Well, a winter count, if you're not familiar with it, is a way that many native peoples, especially plains peoples, use to record their own history. And what you do is you mark the passage of each winter with usually a pictograph commemorating a significant event, okay? So a Mandan winter count keeper named Butterfly recalled the winter of 1866 as our first famine. This was the first time our people ever went hungry, having neither corn nor meat. Now, as we shall see, some other evidence suggests that's not quite correct. But Butterfly's point is well taken. The Mandan lifeway accommodated the unpredictability of North Dakota's climate in all but the most dire circumstances. And in fact, 21st century archaeology has begun to reveal the extent of the Mandan's success. High-tech imaging of sites in the Heart River area has shown that several towns were major population centers. Double Ditch Village, just north of Bismarck, North Dakota, may be the most spectacular and accessible example. The town's name reflects its most striking visible feature. These two clearly discernible fortification trenches that still delineate former boundaries of the palisaded town. Now, when you look at if you were to walk this terrain today, the two trenches would be maybe at most 8 to 12 inches deep. You can step across them, you know, maybe 20, 30, 35, 36 inches wide. Imagine, that's because they've caved in. Imagine these trenches 6 to 7 feet deep, maybe 13, 14 feet across, backed up on the inside with a palisade of pointed stakes, okay? Now, it turns out that the name Double Ditch is misleading. What appears to be the outermost trench does not mark the outermost boundary of the town. Scans completed in 2004 revealed two additional trenches beyond the two visible ones. So in its spatial dimensions, Double Ditch was once much larger than scholars had recognized. And this means that the two visible ditches represent only the town's smaller size as it pulled back in successive contractions. Surveys suggest that another nearby town, a town known today as Larson, also had two additional fortification trenches detectable primarily through magnetic gradiometry. So like Double Ditch, Larson was also much larger than scholars had imagined. So if you're looking at this image, oh shoot, I didn't mean to do that. Let me get it back. If you're looking at this image, this is the innermost ditch you can see today. This is the second ditch you can see today. And then here's a third ditch, invisible to the naked eye. And then most spectacularly, here's a fourth ditch with bastions, also invisible to the naked eye. Now, patterns of expansion and contraction differ from village to village. I'm sure that future scholars are going to add new discoveries. I'm sure they're going to surprise us again, as they did with the work coming out of Double Ditch. For now, however, it's clear that the Mandans in their heyday lived in as many as 21 different villages near the Missouri Heart River confluence. Some of these villages had very brief occupations, but at least six were so-called traditional villages, these very large fortified settlements that lasted into the 18th century, into the 1700s. How many people lived here? It's a very important and complicated question, and to be sure we need more archaeology to help us sort out the answer. I think it's likely that the Mandans at the Heart River towns numbered as many as 12 to 15,000 at their pinnacle, which was perhaps in the mid to late 1500s. And then in the late 1500s, just about 1600, something happened. What follows is a blend of hypothesis and fact. The work coming out of Double Ditch suggests that that outermost ditch is the oldest, representing the town's size, roughly 19 acres, at its founding, around the time Columbus sailed. But in the late 1500s, the villagers apparently abandoned the outer two ditches. Their town shrank to 15 acres, roughly a 20% reduction in size. So they contracted, in other words, into the confines of the outermost of the two ditches that our eyes can discern today. Why did this happen? What caused Double Ditch, as well as Larson and perhaps other nearby towns, to dwindle in size in the late 1500s? Well, you know, we could speculate, we could brainstorm about this. Sanitation might have become a problem as population densities increased. Right? Growing population densities in European towns at the same time, we know created sanitation problems. Another possibility is that Mandan numbers may have overwhelmed the carrying capacity of the land they occupied. And ecologists of the late 20th and early 21st centuries have recognized that carrying capacity is fluid, right? It depends on variables that change over time. You know, and examples of such variables could include climate change or pests that might have undermined the ability of the Mandans to sustain themselves in their traditional fashion. Drought, in particular, was widespread during the 1500s. And a recently recognized mega drought actually inflicted much of North America and Mexico with conditions far more severe than those of the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. And it hit the upper Missouri region with particular force between 1574 and 1609. So I think we need to be nimble in our thinking about this. You know, even if the Mandans had enough food to sustain themselves during these hard years, drought may have made them the targets of raids by other peoples. Yeah, and think about it. With their permanent locations, with their abundant food supplies, Mandan towns were always tempting targets. And the very fact that fortifications surrounded the towns indicates that some kind of external threat existed in the period we're talking about. Other hazards of drought include grasshoppers, still the bane of prairie farmers today. They proliferate in dry conditions. One 21st century appraisal warns farmers that grasshopper populations can double, triple, or quadruple with each successive year of drought. Another possible cause of population collapse is not pests, but pestilence. And there is speculation that indigenous hantavirus carried by rodent vectors may have caused widespread human mortality in these years. Hantavirus is carried by deer mice. As some of you may recall, it was only identified back in 1993. But hantavirus has existed for much, much longer than that. Hantavirus does exist in North Dakota, and drought conditions typically expedite its spread. But I don't think this is a very likely cause of the depopulation that we're talking about today. I don't think it was very likely that hantavirus was the cause. I do think that infectious disease may well have been the culprit. Wave after wave of sickness swept Mexico in the aftermath of Hernan Cortez's smallpox-assisted conquest of the Mexica people, or the Aztecs, in 1521. There were at least 10 severe epidemics from 1531 to 1595. And that doesn't even include that terrible, famous initial smallpox outbreak that accompanied Cortez. So I said that there are at least 10 severe epidemics between 1531 and 1595. There is no doubt that smallpox and measles were among these early outbreaks. And bear in mind, you know, things like smallpox, measles, influenza, these are new species. These are new species, and they are species that had a dramatic effect on America's native populations. So the question is whether any of these contagions reached the upper Missouri River during the 1500s. And the possibility is strongest for infections like measles, like smallpox, infections that have long incubation periods. You know, an extended incubation period promotes the spread of contagion. It promotes the spread of contagion by allowing infected individuals to travel long distances before falling sick. Just think about HIV and the way it spread, and you'll understand the implications of this. So let's think about this as it relates to the Mandans. The population of Double Ditch appears to have collapsed just before 1600. This is early. That's before Jamestown, before Santa Fe has been established, before Quebec. This is early. So the population of Double Ditch appears to have collapsed just before 1600. The first European trade items, a sparse handful of glass beads and iron implements, reached the Mandans right around the same time, penetrating to the heart of the continent well in advance of Europeans. But logic suggests that new trade items and new contagions might have arrived around the same time. If the trade items could get there, so too could microbes. The timing is obviously close. Unfortunately, we can't say for sure that epidemic disease caused or contributed to the population collapse at Double Ditch and other Mandan towns just before 1600. It's certainly possible. Now, uncertainty dissipates with the passage of time. By the early 1700s, Plains life was in upheaval again due to the arrival of the horse, another new species, well, sort of new, because horses originated here and then came back. But I will call it another new species to the Great Plains and to the Americas. And Plains peoples embraced these animals after New Mexico's Pueblo Revolt of 1680 made them more widely accessible. And horses spread northward over the course of the 1700s. The Mandans probably got their first horses around 1740. Might have been a couple of years earlier. They had certainly seen horses a few years earlier. So the Mandans probably got their first horses around 1740, but itinerant equestrianism did not become a way of life for the Mandans as it did for so many Plains peoples. Didn't become a way of life, but it still changed many things for the Mandans. It changed Mandan gender roles. It changed work assignments. It changed warfare, as you can imagine. It changed the nature of wealth and its accumulation. It changed living arrangements in an earth lodge. And most obviously, the arrival of the horse changed travel and commerce. Commerce was the very center of Mandan life. You know, the Heart River towns were essentially a giant permanent rendezvous site. You know, think Mall of America, but with a fabulously rich social and cultural life. And horses meant easier, more frequent interaction between peoples than ever before. Horses also hauled or carried much more than dogs or humans ever could. They carried trade items. They carried food. They carried teepees. Their riders also carried invisible cargoes, things like news, information, cultural traditions, and sometimes microbes. Now, obviously, news and information are coveted commodities. Microbes are not. Whether or not new diseases had struck the Mandans and caused the great collapse in the pedestrian era of the late 1500s, we know they did so in the equestrian era of the 1700s and 1800s. Smallpox or some other infection afflicted northern plains peoples in the 1730s. And among those who suffered were the Lakota Sioux, who raided and traded among the upper Missouri villagers. Now, Lakota winter count recalls the winter of 1734-1735 as used them up with bellyache winter. And it marks the year's passage with a figure bearing two distinctive features. First, a midsection spiral indicating abdominal distress. And second, I mean, I apologize, it's a black and white image, but the secondly, an overlay of red dots like those used to designate a smallpox rash. And since vomiting is a classic early symptom of smallpox, the pictured symptoms taken together make it likely that this was, in fact, the pestilence of the 1730s. Now, if this infection reached the Lakota Sioux and probably the Arikara people, the Arikaras were Earth Lodge dwellers who lived downriver on the Missouri, south of the Mandans. So if the infection reached the Lakota Sioux and probably reached the Arikaras downstream from the Mandans, did it also reach the Mandans? Well, no written or oral accounts of this such an outbreak survive. Where else can we look? The telltale evidence may well lie buried in ghost towns like Larson and Doubleditch. So remember, by 1600 or so, the Mandans and Doubleditch had ensconced themselves behind their second fortification ring, which we can still see today. At some point, the villagers contracted again, taking shelter behind the innermost ditch and palisade. And the cause may well have been the epidemic of 1734-35. Regardless of exactly when and how it happened, we do know that Mandan towns like Double Ditch and Larson had suffered stunning population loss by the middle of the 1700s. By which time they were ensconced behind that innermost fortification trench. So, Double Ditch circa 1500 had contained 160 homes and approximately 2,000 people. By the mid 1700s, it appears to have been 80% smaller, with 32 homes and no more than 400 people hunkered down inside the smallest ditch that you can see here. And then disaster struck again. In 1781, smallpox made its way to the upper Missouri River from Spanish settlements to the south. The precise route that it followed is not clear, but fleet-footed horses made its transit easy. Comanches, Pawnees, Arikaras, Shoshones, Dakotas, Blackfeet, Assiniboines, Crees, Hidatsas, Mandans, everyone contracted the infection. Among the Mandans, it undermined families, age group societies, and clan and bundle lines. Of 13 clans, 6 survived. The Mandans reeled, and the Lakota Sioux closed in. With their population depleted, and with the threat of violence from the Lakotas apparently growing, the Mandans sought safety in numbers. They accomplished this by moving 40 or 50 miles north from the heart of the world, and now living cheek by jowl beside their Hidatsa neighbors, another group of Earth Lodge dwellers who lived along the Missouri above the Mandans. So they joined the Hidatsas at the confluence of the Knife River and the Missouri. And those Heart River villages, once the home to thousands, became ghost towns. When Lewis and Clark passed through, 23 years after the epidemic, Clark marked the empty town sites on his map. And you can see them identified here. Now, I wish we knew more about Mandan efforts to reconstitute their lives in the aftermath of this episode. We do know that at Onaslant Village, a venerable chief named Good Boy rallied his people, and all of the west side towns consolidated into a single new one below the Hidatsas, still on the west bank of the river. The east bank Mandans, they were known as the Nuptadis, including those at Double Ditch and Larson, did the same thing. And they built a new settlement upstream on their own side of the river. So essentially, the Mandans and Hidatsas went from living in a configuration of towns that looked like this to a configuration of towns that looked like this. So by 1797, the Mandans lived in 2 Missouri River towns, one on the east bank, one on the west, near the mouth of the Knife River. The Mandans by this time numbered roughly 1,500 people in all. And remember, 2.5 centuries earlier, there may have been 15,000. The Mandan migration to the Knife River coincided with a growing European-American presence on the Northern Plains. And with that presence came a burgeoning written record, as travelers such as David Thompson, Lewis and Clark, George Catlin, Prince Maximilian, Carl Bodmer, scores of less famous tourists and traders spent time in the Knife River towns. Their writings and their images reveal much of what followed. Foreign diseases, now much easier to identify, swirled across the plains. Whooping cough coursed through the villages in the summer of 1806, filling earth lodges with that desperate whistle-like wheezing that gives the infection its name. Whooping cough may have struck again in 1813 and 14. And it definitely struck the Mandans 5 years later, this time in tandem with measles. These twin infections, according to the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company, first showed themselves at the Mandan villages and have from them spread all over the country. So as focal points of commerce, the Knife River villages were also focal points of contagion. And reports of the infection are abundant for the Assiniboines, for the Sioux, for other nearby peoples. Now more challenges came quickly, as the St. Louis fur trade extended its reach northward. I mentioned deer mice earlier as possible carriers of hantavirus. Well, deer mice were a constant, notorious problem in Mandan earth lodges. Residents of the Mandan town of Mitatahankush, pictured here, complained that deer mice were very destructive and that they chewed clothing and other manufacturers to pieces in a lamentable manner. But it's worth noting that despite Mandan complaints, deer mice rarely burrow. So they left those underground grain caches alone. Well, in 1825, a visiting U.S. keelboat brought another new species to Mitatahankush. And it was a species that put the deer mouse in perspective. That new creature was the Norway rat, also called the brown rat, sewer rat, or wharf rat. For the Mandans, the sight of a new creature was a momentous occasion, perhaps even a visitation of the spirits. The artist, ethnographer George Catlin, and I should say we need to take George Catlin's writings with a grain of salt, but what he reported that hundreds came to watch and look at the strange animal. No one, he said, dared to kill it. And when the Indians saw a Norway rat devouring a deer mouse, they were delighted. Right? Perhaps if these new creatures multiplied, they would rid their earth lodges of those bothersome deer mice. You know, perhaps the spirits had indeed intervened. Well, the rats did multiply, and they multiplied quickly. I will spare you the full details of rat reproduction that I learned in the course of this research, but I do want to share one item with you from the rat scholar Jonathan Burt. Litters can be as large as 14, but generally average between 6 and 8, he writes. Females can be ready to mate as soon as 18 hours after giving birth, and offspring are sexually mature by 3 months. Moreover, rats are assiduous burrowers. They spend much of their life underground. And this aspect of rat ecology combined with their prodigious reproductive rate to create dreadful consequences. The Mandans' underground grain caches were formidable constructions. I mean, these things were fabulous. They were 6 to 7 feet deep. Women used ladders to descend into them. So they were formidable constructions, but they were obviously underground, and they were no match for the rats. With a seemingly bottomless storehouse of maize to consume, the rats burrowed and multiplied. George Catlin observed that within 6 years of the rat's arrival at Mitatahankush, the animals had, in his words, infested every wigwam, and the Indians' caches where they buried their corn and other provisions were robbed and sacked. So voracious were the rats that earth lodge floors buckled and collapsed, no longer supported by stores of grain below. Archaeologists have calculated that rat bones constitute 54% of all microanimal remains at Fort Clark. Fort Clark was the little American Fur Company post that sat beside Mitatahankush. The map here, this is probably drawn by somebody who'd never even seen the site, but it does give you a sense of the proximity. In fact, Fort Clark is closer to Mitatahankush than that. I mean, they're literally side by side. 54% of microanimal remains at Fort Clark were rat bones. Fort Clark was staffed by a notoriously cantankerous a trader named Francis Chardon. He kept a journal. You can get a sense of the man by seeing what he tracked in his journal. And I have here, I pulled out some excerpts for you. He tabulated the number of rats he killed. I just pulled out a year's worth for you. So you can see that June of 1836, killed 82 rats this month. You know, he keeps a running total so that a year later, May 1837, his running total of rats killed in Fort Clark alone is 1,686. And the point I'd make is that that's in Fort Clark. Where do you think most of the corn was? Right? I mean, so just imagine the rat infestation in the village. In fact, the rats were so abundant that they chewed up the stakes of the palisade around Mizzahunkush. Now, in 1832, as the rats ran amok, a steamboat named Yellowstone churned up the Missouri River, docking below Mizzahunkush to service Fort Clark. Yellowstone was the first steamer to reach the Mandans. And like the other boats that followed, it had a voracious appetite. Not for maize, but for wood. Now, to be clear, the Mandans consumed plenty of wood on their own for fuel, for fortifications, for earth lodge construction. Earth lodges were essentially post and beam structures. I mean, they look like earth, but they're mostly wood. So the Mandans used wood for fuel, for fortifications, for earth lodges. They even used it for horse fodder. Steamboats were in a different league. A small steamer like the Yellowstone needed 12 cords of wood, the equivalent of 60 10-inch trees for each day of travel. And the boats inevitably reloaded with wood at Mizzahunkush. German Prince Maximilian noted as early as 1833-34 that wood was in short supply near Mizzahunkush. The nearby forests, he observed, had only a very small quantity of useful timber. Now, these dwindling forests had far-reaching effects. In the winter, the Mandans and the bison herds alike migrated to the Missouri River's forested bottomlands to escape the full force of the weather. For the Mandans, this made for easy hunting and abundant meat in an otherwise difficult season. But now, with few trees, the river bottom offered little shelter, and the winter bison herds went elsewhere. Mandans starving, the fort full of men, women, and children begging meat, wrote Francis Chardon on December 3rd, 1836. Chardon reported plenty of bison 30 miles off on February 4th, 1837. 10 days later, the same situation prevailed. Mandans all starving, he wrote, although cattle meaning bison, are within 30 miles of the fort. So why didn't the Mandans go hunt them? This time, Chardon added a key bit of information. Fear, he said, caused the Mandans to keep at home. Throughout that winter of 1836-37, the Lakota people hung close to Mizzahunkush, and sightings of enemies came in regularly and sent ripples of panic through the Mandan towns. There are actually two towns. There's Mizzahunkush, and there's a little town called Nuptadi just upstream from it. So in fact, the Lakota Sioux presence added to hunting pressure, frightened bison and frightened villagers too. So the Mandans thus faced a three-dimensional problem in the winter of 1836 and 37. Their corn was too meager. The rats were eating it. The Lakota Sioux were too close, and the bison were too far away. In April of 1837, two additional pressures came to bear. The first is a mystery. For some reason, the thawing Missouri River ice failed to yield up its annual supply of float bison, an important source of nourishment in the leanest of seasons in the spring. The Mandans have lost all hope of catching the drowned buffalo, said Chardon, as not one has passed this year. Second, the entire Arikara tribe, perhaps as many as 2,000 people, sought shelter with the Mandans after abandoning their own villages and actually testing out nomadic life for a year. Now, Mandans and Arikaras were traditional enemies, but the Mandans offered the Arikaras temporary quarters, hoping that together they might fend off the Lakota Sioux. The net effect was still more strain on the Mandans' paltry food stores. The cruelest blow came 2 months later. On June 18, 1837, the fur company's steamer St. Peter's landed at Mitsitohunkush. On board were passengers, supplies, and the smallpox virus. What followed is one of the most calamitous and oft-recited episodes in the history of the American West, documented day by day in Francis Chardon's journal. 56 years had passed since 1781, when the last smallpox epidemic had struck the Mandans. None but the elderly had acquired immunity. A young Mandan died today of the smallpox, Chardon wrote on July 14, 1837. Several others has caught it. Thereafter, the pox ripped through both Mitsitohunkush and Niptati, the smaller Mandan town just upstream. In August, the Mandans who could do so abandoned Mitsitohunkush. The women scoured the streets of the town looking for orphans belonging to their clans, and then they fled, leaving all that were sick in the village to heal or die on their own. You can only imagine what that making that decision was like. The villagers' departure was a desperate act of self-preservation. The residents of Mitsitohunkush camped on the far side of the Missouri until late September 1837. And then Chardon said the 41 survivors of Mitsitohunkush left as the Arikara people, the Arikaras had been inhabiting the Mandans' winter village down in the river bottoms. The Arikara people took over their town and moved into their earth lodges. In fact, Chardon was wrong. He said 41 survivors. The number was closer to 200 or 300. So think about this. The year was 1837. The Mandans had lived through no more than a century and a half of direct contact with European newcomers. The famous Indian Wars of the West had barely begun. That phrase, manifest destiny, had yet to be coined. Railroads and white homesteaders had yet to arrive. There had been no violence between Mandans and European Americans. But events had already brought one of the great nations of the plains to the brink of destruction, and they had survived. And the resilience of the Mandans, who lived on by virtue of their toughness, their kindness, their openness, their wisdom, and their cultural and spiritual wealth, is an inspiration to us all. Thank you. Should we take a question and answer? Q&A?
Yeah.
Sure.
We have time for some questions? Yes.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
I unfortunately haven't read your book, but I still have a few questions.
That's okay.
methodologically speaking, how did you piece together, because I've read some book reviews, how did you piece together all these fascinating disciplines, like archaeology, anthropology, geology, climatology, epidemiology, nutritional science, and so on. So how did you much actually, you have to know of each field to make such diverse research findings meet?
Well, I learned a lot actually writing my first book on...
Maybe you could repeat.
Okay, the question is, is given the wide variety of methodologies of sort of resources and sources that I use to cobble together this story, how much did I have to know about each? enough. And it's actually a lesson that I learned doing my first book, which is, you know, about smallpox. And I had never even taken a class in medical history. I had dropped out of biological sciences and all when I was an undergraduate. And I went and I just planted myself in the med school library on the floor in the stacks with all the smallpox books around me. And I learned everything I could, and I talked to people who were experts and said, you know, explain the way T cells work, right? And you can do that in any discipline. So, you know, historians tend to think, and in graduate school, we think very arduously about methodology. And people ask me about my methodology. I say, my methodology is common sense. You know, I'm going to say, okay, I've got a problem here. Where might I look for the answer? Yeah, and you know, if it's geology, read some geology books, and if there's something I don't understand, I'll talk to geologists. You know, and we don't need all the intricacies of these sciences, and in this case, to answer some of the questions we have. Now, sometimes those intricacies may matter and matter deeply, and then we need to talk to people in other disciplines and find out about it. But I encourage historians, especially historians that are looking to cross that artificial divide at 1492. You know, I mean, everything before 1492 is American history too, right? We just aren't going to get access to it in most cases by written materials. So my answer to you is really enough. You know, I had to know enough. And when I didn't feel confident, I would talk to people. You know, I had a neighbor who was an immunologist. I'd go over and I'd watch for her lights to come on in the morning. And as soon as they came on, go over, knock on the door. She'd go, oh my God, you know. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, Mandan women were fabulous. I mean, boy, do we owe a debt of gratitude to their maize cultivation, to all these varieties that, you know, really contributed to American agriculture as we know it today. And one of the lessons I learned in doing this is, you know, the work of Native women is so often portrayed as drudge work. And, man, so it's women who construct earth lodges. They're moving these massive cottonwoods. You know, they're building houses. Do we talk about men building houses today? Do we speak of that as drudge work? You know, I mean, this was dangerous, skilled, arduous labor. And you know, man, I was very surprised at how much I ended up writing about Mandan women. Yeah. They really became a central focus, much to my delight. Yeah.
It was interesting to me that when a man married, he went to live with the woman's family.
He did. And Mandan kinship patterns are very interesting. So they were matrilocal. So when a man married the woman, you know, he'd go and live in her family's earth lodge. And he also counted all of her sisters as wives. And offspring counted all the mother's sisters as mothers. So, there's language in this book that's kind of challenging when a child might refer to her mothers, plural, which is quite, discombobulating to us. But that's the way Mandans tracked their kinship. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I'm sure you cover this in the book, but what's the basis of, there's been some references to how, I don't know if friendly is the right word, open the Mandans were, and yet, I mean, on what basis do they have that kind of openness to visitors?
Yeah, it was a deep-seated Mandan tradition of being open to visitors, and it's if you're a commercial people, it's almost a necessary premise. Mandan villages were safe areas, so even if you were an enemy, once you were in a village, you would not be harmed. They had longstanding traditions of exogamy, you know, marrying, intermarrying with other peoples to establish trade, commercial, and diplomatic ties, just like European monarchs did. But they were very, very open, and they were culturally open too. You know, so if another nation had a ceremony they liked, they'd buy the ceremony from them and adopt it as their own. And it's a wonderful, you know, now these same social and cultural patterns may also have contributed to their vulnerability to infection, right? And that, and they're living in these densely populated villages, certainly played a part in that.
But there wasn't like a spiritual basis to it.
Well, how do you separate it? How do you separate it? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is a Cornhusker question. So the corn grown by the inhabitants of Mesa Verde, when I've read and seen, their ears of corn were like about 3 or 4 inches. And yet, from your picture you showed there, and...
Okay, well, that's a 20th century photograph.
Yeah, so how right. Were the ears of corn? They grew a lot of corn, so they couldn't have been 2 or 3 inches.
Right, right. No, they're in between. They're in between what we know today, right? And those little, but even some of the Anasazi corn, yeah. I mean, I've seen in Grand Gulch and all, yeah. But it's going to be in between. It's going to be in between. Yeah. Jefferson grew Mandan corn. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I was just blown away by the amount of underground storage they had.
I was too, and the archaeologists were also blown away by the extent of the sort of underground storage capacity. What you're looking at here, this is an Earth Lodge site there, so it's a huge, you know, Earth Lodges would be 30 to 60 feet maybe in diameter, and then like if you were to do an overhead, you could see it on those images of Double Ditch, if you were to fly overhead, you see all these big circles, but then there are smaller ones, and the smaller ones are cache pits. And using all these non-invasive archaeological techniques now, ground-penetrating radar, electrical resistance testing, magnetic radiometry, it's amazing what archaeologists are now able to map. And that's how they're calculating the storage capacity. Now, it's important to remember, you know, when you hear these huge numbers, 70,000 bushels of storage capacity at Hough, for example, you know, not all those cache pits were necessarily used at the same time. But still, as I said, you know, Hough, for example, it's only occupied for 20 years, it's only occupied for a generation. So I would venture that most of those cache pits were used. And there was, as you could see from those slides, there's a very specific way you were supposed to store your corn. You'd put ears of corn around the outside and loose kernels in the middle. It was real marvelous technology until this new species arrived.
It was a great home for the rats, wasn't it?
Yeah, God, it was a great home for the rats. Yeah. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I want to talk about bison and antelope and deer for meat, but being the river people, did they consume fish?
Yes, they did consume fish, and the protein consumption patterns are fascinating because they differ dramatically village to village. There's some evidence, too, of change over time. And what we can expect, so Double Ditch Village is over on the east bank of the river, right? And if you're familiar with the history, the Lakota people are expanding out of the Western Great Lakes toward the Mandans, right? And we see in the mid-18th century, Double Ditch residents start eating more and more fish. Now, we can't necessarily attribute cause and effect, but I would speculate that bison hunting became more dangerous because you're subject to Lakota attack. You're right there on the river, fish becomes a preferable protein source. At the same time, on the west bank of the river, at Honest Land Village, they're eating bison galore. But they're on the west bank of the river. You know, so it's probably safer for them to go out on the bison hunt. So it's fascinating because these consumption patterns change over time and they differ from village to village. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, you have another one?
Sorry, second and last question.
Sure.
You mentioned during the lecture that there was no bias between the Mandan people and settlers. But how important were the Mandan villages to U.S. officials?
Well, I was actually misled. There was actually one incident of violence that I will mention. The story, at least, is that some young Mandan men mistook a party of fur traders for Arikaras, and they killed one man in a supposedly misguided attack. I'm not sure that was true. I think they were fur traders who were bypassing the Mandans. So the Mandans were very important until the fur trade, until the era of the mountain men, until steamboats and the fur trade bypassed the Mandans, they built Fort Union and pushed into the Rocky Mountains, and then the Mandans became just kind of a way station, through which sometimes furs passed, but even Indian visitors diminished in number. After Fort Union was established, the Mandans were no longer the place you had to go, and they became just sort of a second tier trading center after Fort Union and after the fur trade opened up into the Rocky Mountains area. I don't know if that answers your question. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Has the Mandan language survived?
Oh, that's a good question. There's one fluent Mandan speaker, Mr. Ed Benson. He's probably approaching 90 years old now. He is working with some younger people through the tribal college in Newtown, North Dakota, to try to perpetuate the language. He's been recorded singing songs and talking, just laying out vocabulary, speaking. It's not clear it's not clear that the language will survive. They're doing their best.
How's your memory?
I can't speak. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. Archaeology there must show deaths of people of all ages at this period, right?
We don't have a lot of burials that have been exposed, and now because of NAGPRA, we're not going to. Interestingly, a lot of these heart of the world sites, Slant Village, Double Ditch, Larson, a lot of those sites on the Middle Missouri is what it's technically called, were preserved, and there wasn't a lot of archaeological work done there because much of the early 20th century, through the 50s and all, so much archaeological effort was expended doing salvage archaeology as the Corps of Engineers was building dams. So the archaeologists were like, oh my God, that village is about to be inundated, we gotta go dig. And the Mandan country was not inundated, at least at the confluence of the Heart River and the Missouri. The Missouri River still runs free through there. So those villages were left relatively untouched. There were probably burials from these smallpox epidemics. We do have some evidence that burial patterns may have changed, possibly as a consequence of epidemics, whereas traditionally Mandans buried people in the ground. There's some evidence suggesting that they adopted more of the Lakota technique of using scaffold burials, which might not leave the kinds of remains that you're talking about.
Does smallpox show this kind of pattern elsewhere, where you can see men and women and children all dying?
Ann Ramanofsky has speculated that, The problem is, smallpox doesn't leave osteological evidence. It doesn't, so you can't identify the cause of death as smallpox from remains. Yeah. So I don't. It's not a very good answer to your question, but it's, you know, it's very hard.
One last question. Yeah. Anybody got one last question? Yes, in the back.
Are there any two Mandans left?
That's an interesting question, and the answer is yes, but no. I mean, you know, because Mandans always intermarried with so many people, and what it means to be Mandan is to almost to look outward and to mix with others. So the Mandans now live in North Dakota on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. They're one of the three affiliated tribes, Mandans, Hidatsas, and Arikaras. And you know, everybody has intermarried. And intermarried with others too, but people still self-identify as Mandan or Hidatsa or Arikara or you know or Sanish.
So, when those three tribes are sites, how many people are we talking about?
On the reservation today, about 5,000, but that doesn't include oil workers, because they are smack dab in the middle of the Bakken Shale, and which has, you know, real consequences. Now, actually, the last year, because oil prices collapsed, now all the rigs are pulling out just when they finished building all the housing. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.